It's a place where they welcome the homeless with open arms. While most cities and towns roust them from doorways and highway culverts with nightsticks and police dogs, this small town has established a holiday to honor them. On the second week in August every year, they begin arriving by hitchhiking, by bicycle, and of course, by sneaking aboard railroad boxcars that are headed that way. Proudly identifying themselves as hobos, they set up a tent camp they call by the traditional name of a jungle, where old acquaintances meet each other, stories are swapped, and songs are sung of lives spent riding the rails. The guests of honor are now mostly older men and just a few women, grizzled and hardened from lives of wandering back and forth across the country, with the open road and the railroad their only permanent homes. The first ceremony is the yearly fire lighting performed to the words of the legendary hobo Frisco Jack. As tourists, local families, and clusters of children gather around the stacked wood for the bonfire, the master of ceremonies leads the crowd in a salute to the four winds, each one having a distinct character that marks the rhythms of the hobo life. As the flames grow higher, ashes from other hobo jungles in other parts of the country are reverently poured on the bonfire. Smoke infuses their clothing, and the dancing firelight flickers on the faces of spectators as they are welcomed in to the fraternity of American hobos. Welcome to Places of Legend, a podcast that digs into places with stories. Stories that are shared in schoolyards, on sidewalks, in urban legends, age-old superstitions, and internet memes. It's far from the history that is usually taught in school books. Let's call it cultural heritage with a weird and unexpected twist. The legends can be scary, they can be hilarious or grotesque, and the truth behind them is almost always hidden. Places of Legend offers up stories that pull back the curtain at famous historic sites around the country, historic places with very different stories to tell. I'm Angela Labrador, and with my colleague and author Neil Silberman, we hope to turn your ideas about America's places of legend upside down. In this episode, our place of legend is Britt, Iowa, home of the annual Hobo Convention, a celebration that first took place here almost 120 years ago. The town's Hobo Museum sells t-shirts and figurines with the familiar hobo image. A man wearing a derby hat, ragged clothes, oversized shoes, and carrying a stick and cloth bindle over his shoulder. But the reality behind the stereotype penetrates the unspoken paradox of America's fascination with the open road and its fear and hatred of those who refuse to settle down. On the second morning of the Hobo Convention, the participants tend to the graves of those who have caught the westbound. Unlike other places, where the bodies of anonymous drifters end up unclaimed in city morgues, the people of Britt, Iowa, have dedicated a special section of their evergreen cemetery to hobos. The simplest markers in the National Hobo Memorial are inscribed cement slabs that sit flush with the grass. Yet even in death, they give the otherwise anonymous drifters distinctive identities. "Here lies Milwaukee Mike," reads one. Others mark the final resting places of many others. Cinderbox Cindy, Iowa Blackie, Hobo Joe, Redhead, and Railroad Randy, a friend to all. Their ashes were brought from near and far by fellow hobos to Britt to be interred in the Hobo Cemetery, the closest thing to a place on Earth where they might possibly feel at home. Hobo culture is associated in the popular imagination with rootlessness and never-ending travel, hopping a freight train in one city and jumping off in another, seeking odd jobs for food among strangers in unfamiliar places, and living rough in hobo jungles under bridges and beside riverbanks. But as we'll see, the roving life of the hobo as expressed in the wistful, plaintive songs of Jimmie Rodgers, Woody Guthrie, and Boxcar Willie was never completely free. At places like Britt, Iowa, where the culture of the hobo is celebrated and honored, we can see close up how it lies at the very heart of the American experience, challenging us to reconsider our deepest understandings of the meanings of home and homelessness. From the very beginning of European settlement, the roads and byways of America have always been filled with wanderers, itinerant tradesmen and laborers, fugitives, heretics, and rebels of every kind have always sought a path to freedom that led off into unknown and unfamiliar places, somewhere beyond the restrictive bonds of family obligations and everyday norms. Indeed, immigration to America from Europe was itself a kind of deliberate escape from home, with rampant hunger, disease, and religious wars, and rigid class systems imprisoning the poor and hopeless life prospects, the decision to leave behind the burdens of kin and kingdom, and seek individual success, motivated many transatlantic migrations. Unfortunately, the possibility of escaping social restrictions in the New World proved to be more dream than reality. The tightly controlled religious colonies and plantations of the Eastern Seaboard sternly discouraged the free movement of people, and the punishments meted out to those who nevertheless chose to wander and were brought back to justice were universally severe. To be a vagabond, enslaved or free, man or woman, was to be a criminal deserving of beating, branding, or public humiliation, and such punishment served as a warning to others not to do the same. Yet, the attractions of a wandering life could never be extinguished in a continent as large and as rich in resources as North America. As the edge of European settlement spread westward, and as wage labor grew more common, the phenomenon of young men setting out from their farms and villages to join work gangs building roads and canals, mining coal, and chopping down forests became a commonplace model for frontier manhood, at least until the time came to take a wife and settle down. Yet the unexpectedly jarring rhythms of the American economy caused many to begin or resume their wandering. Economic panics, recessions, and whole-scale depressions resulted in the foreclosure of farms, the closure of businesses, and the widespread loss of jobs that set armies of tramps on the road again. The biggest wave came after the Civil War, when the railroad lines formed an increasingly dense network of depots, freight yards, and mail stops that afforded free transportation to those who were nimble enough to hop into empty boxcars headed to some place, rumor said, that could offer better prospects for handouts and temporary work. After the Wall Street crashes of the 1870s and 90s, thousands of men and boys adopted what was soon called the hobo lifestyle, riding the rails from coast to coast, hopping on and off the steady flow of freight trains, and surviving in the shack and tent encampments called hobo jungles that sprang up near major rail junctions and depot towns. No one knows for sure where the name hobo came from. Many theories have been proposed over the years. Possibilities range from improbable foreign origins like the Latin homo bonus for good man, or the French ou beau, meaning high gentleman, to the more prosaic, such as the railroad greeting, ho boy, or the slang term for the lowliest farm worker, the ho boy. Whatever its derivation, by the 1890s, the term hobo was widely known as a term of ridicule or shame. The familiar figure of the tramp with the battered hat and bindle became a favorite target for arrest and roughing up by railroad security guards, and a popular comic character on the vaudeville stage.
I am the famous flowery bum you hear so much about. The ladies hide their pocketbooks whenever I go out. I'm noted for my dirty work, no matter what I do. Now everybody hates me, and I hope you hate me too. I met a man the other day on Pitt Street on a grand, and asked him for a dime to buy a cup of coffee, and said he to me, "You dirty bum, you better move along. The coffee that you drink, I think, is quite a bit too strong. They always give me the bum's rush. I'm getting weary today."
Britt, Iowa was itself a creation of the railroads. Established on a tract of North Iowa prairie as a stopping place along a spur line of the Chicago, Milwaukee, and St. Paul Railway, legend has it that it was named after an engineer or brakeman named Britt, who regularly passed this way. Naturally enough, the first building to be constructed was a depot, and by the mid-1880s, it had become a prosperous little commercial town. We have no record of hobos passing through Britt during its early years, but it is almost certain that thousands did, since the Britt Spur was part of the main rail connection between the enormous metropolis of Chicago and the farms, mines, and forests of the Great Plains and Pacific Northwest. For the townspeople of Britt, however, the goal was to stay put and establish a stable place they could call home. Its broad main street was lined with stores, a bank, post office, livery stables, and a daily newspaper office to serve its residents and the farm families from the surrounding areas of Hancock County, who came to market their crops and deliver them for shipment eastward at the depot. As the editor of the Britt Tribune, Edwin Bailey, put it proudly, "From humble and discouraging start, Britt has grown to be the largest town in the county and the center of a large trading and farming district, a town of prosperous and modern stores, strong financial institutions, and civic excellence." Indeed, Britt, Iowa offered the very model of settled Gilded Age propriety and decorum that the era's hobos sought to avoid at all costs. But, as it turned out, an unexpected convergence of interests brought the hobos and the Britt businessmen together. Recognition and good publicity. Despite, or maybe because of, the Great Financial Panic of 1893, towns vied with other towns for business and attention. Then, as now, festivals, commemorations, and conventions added to a newly established town's economic appeal. And that was the goal of three Britt businessmen: banker Thomas Way, pharmacist Truman Potter, and lawyer W.E. Bradford. They all sought to do something different to show the world that Britt was a lively little town capable of doing anything that larger cities could do. But what could Britt, with its population of only a few hundred, offer that big cities or even other small Iowa railroad towns couldn't? The answer was Tourist Union Number 63.
If you'll only stop, then we'll just get up your yacht. I'll relate to you a story of a tramp. He was not the kind that shirked. He was looking hard for work, but he heard that same old story everywhere. Tramp, 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 keep on a tramping. Nothing doing here for you. If I catch you here again, you will wear.
By the late 1890s, the hobo life was a hazardous occupation. Riding the rails was physically dangerous. In the decade between 1898 and 1908, the Interstate Commerce Commission estimated that 48,000 tramps were killed in accidents on freight trains, and an equal number were maimed. Murders were common in hobo jungles, and the brutal railroad security guards would shoot trespassers on sight. No less perilous was the reputation that hobos had been saddled with. Even the most innocent and honest tramps were suspected of criminality or subversion. The Radical International Workers of the World had declared hobos to be the new proletariat that would rise up against capitalist exploitation, and local police were always on the lookout to drive arriving hobos out of town. And as the story goes, a small group of hobos decided they would organize to improve their public image. Having all experienced arrest, harassment, and beatings, they believed that if they established a protective welfare organization for themselves, they could live their wandering lifestyle in peace. There were 63 original members, all residing in a single hobo jungle by the Mississippi in St. Louis. Before they scattered to their various destinations, they drew up a code of good conduct that they hoped would protect them from police intimidation. They named their new organization of fellow wanderers Tourist Union No. 63. Like other labor unions of the time, Tourist Union No. 63 began to hold a national convention every August at which their growing membership of hobos would gather. They proudly celebrated their choice of lifestyle, inducted new members, and elected an annual king, queen, crown prince, and crown princess of the hobos. They also elected a chief executive and arbiter of the code of conduct, named after the locomotive term of Grand Head Pipe. Uncharacteristically, they were not afraid of publicity. In fact, they welcomed it. And so it came about that the 1899 Hobo Convention held in Chicago was fully covered by the city's dailies. And a copy of a newspaper describing the event arrived a few days later in Britt, Iowa, by train. That was how the Britt Boosters first learned of the Hobo Union and its annual convention. They immediately recognized that hosting a national convention of righteous hobos would finally put Britt on the map. So they wasted no time in inviting the newly elected Grand Head Pipe, Charles F. Noe, to come to Britt to discuss holding their next convention there. Grand Head Pipe Noe arrived in Britt in the autumn of 1899 and was wined and dined by the civic leaders. Attorney W.E. Bradford drew up a legal agreement to ensure that they would come. Noe returned to Chicago to convey the news to the other union officers, while the editor of the Britt Tribune, Edwin Bailey, took charge of a national publicity campaign. His press releases and articles about the scheduled hobo convention captured the imagination of reporters all over the country. It was a newsworthy sensation that an otherwise respectable small town in Iowa would welcome hobos as honored guests. But as it turned out, the civic leaders of Britt treated the event as little more than a tongue-in-cheek publicity stunt. On the appointed day of August 22, 1900, the town of Britt was decked out as if for visiting heads of state. Red, white, and blue bunting was draped on all the storefronts on Main Street, and the town's most impressive building bore a sign that Britt was now officially the hobo headquarters of the world. morning, a large delegation from Chicago arrived with the Hobo King, who happened to be named Onion Cotton, and Grand Head Pipe Charles No. Their arrival was greeted with a brass band and speeches. Newspaper reporters from big city newspapers in Chicago, Minneapolis, St. Louis, Philadelphia, and Omaha had come on the assumption that it was all just a big joke. But the hobos took it as their debut in the national spotlight. In fact, leading up to the convention, thousands of members of Tourist Union No. 63 had been hopping boxcars headed for Britt. A newspaper from a town on the Illinois-Iowa border reported, "For the past few days, this city has been full of hobos, bound for Britt, Iowa. Every freight train from the east brings in from 10 to 25, to say nothing of the hundreds that are going through the country on foot and by wagon. They sleep in barns at night and beg their food of the farmers. Those in the city sleep in boxcars and wherever they can find a little shelter. On arrival here, the first thing they do is to go down to the Mississippi River, where they cook their food, wash up, and enjoy the luxury of a shave." When one was asked about the reason for all the preparation, he replied, "We're fixing up for our hobo convention. Just like all the boys that will be there, we want to look the best we can." Unfortunately, much of the preparation was wasted. When the mass of hobos finally arrived in Britt and the ceremonies got underway, they recognized that the joke was on them. The Britt Town Fathers had planned a public celebration that took the form of a cruel parody. A local fife and drum corps dressed in silly hobo costumes played ragtime music. Horse races were staged along with baseball games, and the many tourists and residents invited to the spectacle were treated to an open-air barbecue and many gallons of beer. The hobos were the entertainment to be gawked at, not the honored guests. The recognition they had hoped for was lost in gales of laughter, and even the annual election was turned into a farce. With the Spanish-American War now just won, and the U.S. feeling itself an imperial power in its occupation of the Philippines, the fake names of the candidates ridiculed the hobos and parodied current world affairs. In the election ceremony at the Britt Fairgrounds, a man dubbed Admiral Dewey was acclaimed as Hobo King, and another, called Philippine Red, was declared Crown Prince of Tourist Union No. 63. The Britt News reported that it was advertising that Britt was after, and she got it. Needless to say, the hobos were humiliated and angry, and it would be 34 years before they would gather in Britt again.
Rejoice and be glad, for the springtime has come. We can throw down our shovels and go on the bum. Hallelujah, I'm a bum. Hallelujah, bum again. Hallelujah, give us a handout to revive us again. Springtime.
The National Hobo Museum, now occupying the long-abandoned Chief Movie Theater on Main Street, features exhibits on the history and lifeways of the American hobo, illustrated through artifacts, photographs, and a documentary film loop shown at the back of the once cavernous auditorium. Founded in the mid-1970s and now owned by the Britt Hobo Foundation, it's a popular attraction for visitors at convention time, though it underplays one important transition in Britt's hobo history. For while the town prides itself on hosting the National Hobo Convention since 1900, it papers over the vast difference in attitude and intention between the half-ridiculing parody of the town boosters at its first gathering in 1900, with the far more sympathetic and even supportive presentation of the hobo experience beginning in the difficult Depression years. The businessmen and farmers of Britt and surrounding Hancock County began to suffer serious economic problems just after the First World War. The market price for grain, hogs, and other agricultural commodities sank steadily, and after the Wall Street crash of 1929, cash was in short supply for even Britt's most prosperous residents, and many local businesses failed. Life in the tidy little community on the Chicago, Milwaukee, and St. Paul Railway didn't seem quite so tidy anymore. As Iowa historian Tom Moraine put it, fewer families were buying new cars or household appliances. People learned to do without new clothing. Many families could not pay their rent. And ironically, for towns like Britt that had prided themselves on being a safe and secure place to settle down, establish a home, and raise a family, a growing number of young men now found themselves without career prospects or a means for economic survival. Some of these young men fled home by jumping on railroad cars in search of any job they could get. The environmental catastrophe, now known as the Dust Bowl, caused by a deadly mixture of severe drought and the resulting landscape of mechanized agriculture, transformed once rich farmland into powdery, eroded soil. The Dust Bowl further destroyed any sense of economic security throughout the Great Plains. Farm workers by the tens of thousands abandoned all that was familiar to wander westward. And the hobo life expanded from the boxcar to the automobile, as entire farm families loaded up all their movable possessions on the roofs of their Model Ts or the beds of their trucks to join the army of homeless. These new automotive hobos became known as rubber tramps. Ironically, the Depression years could be called the golden age of the hobo. According to the documentary filmmakers Michael Ace and Lexi Lovell, who collected oral histories from dozens of Depression-era hobos, the scale of homelessness, either voluntary or imposed by severe economic hardship, grew to a proportion never seen before. As they reveal in their evocative and sobering film, Riding the Rails, approximately 4 million adults and 250,000 teenage migratory laborers adopted the hobo lifestyle. And they rode the rails, not for pure adventure, but because they had no alternative. The hobo life was a matter of survival, of avoiding the physical dangers that lay in wait in the train yards and moving boxcars, and of discovering where temporary work and food could be found. To that end, the hobos of America developed an increasingly complex culture, with a secret slang and a set of symbols that could be understood by experienced tramps everywhere. Through this underground culture, hobos offered each other vital information. Secret codes consisting of geometric shapes, crude stick figures, and arrows were marked with chalk or paint on bridges, at the base of roadside billboards, and on fences. Various codes indicated the places where a hobo would be welcomed or would be in danger, where they could find generous handouts, a safe place to sleep, or a sympathetic local doctor. Or be warned about grifters, homeowners with itchy trigger fingers, or packs of vicious dogs. Only hobos initiated in the life on the road would even notice these symbols, much less understand what they meant. So it was during this desperate time, when so many were down on their luck and fighting for survival, that at least in some places, hobos earned a new respect. One of these places was northern Iowa, where the farm and town economy was on the verge of collapse. A new radicalism and militancy now swept across the agricultural counties, where neat towns and stern-faced American Gothic farmers had been the rule. Farmers began to organize labor protests and stage strikes by blockading roads and preventing any produce from getting to market, where they would only garner rock-bottom prices. The farmers and townsmen of Britt were at the forefront of the new resistance to the harsh economic conditions, and they recognized that their former comfortable belief in home and the safety of community was neither a fact of nature nor a moral value, but could be subject to political and economic factors that were far beyond their control. An irony of ironies, in 1934, the little town of Britt once again invited the members of the still existing and growing Tourist Union No. 63 to come back to their town every August and hold their National Hobo Convention. But this time, they did it with sympathy for the ideals and culture of the hobos, and not thinly veiled contempt.
One evening as the sun went down and the jungle fires were burning, down the track came a hobo hiking, and he said, "Boys, I'm not turning. I'm heading for a land that's far away beside the crystal fountain. I'll see you all this coming fall in the Big Rock Candy Mountain."
And so, without fail every year since 1934, Britt has held its National Hobo Convention, an event that now draws some 20,000 onlookers and a few hundred now most elderly hobos, who are no longer the butt of humor, but the stars of the show. Although the once vast railroad networks have severely shrunken in the face of superhighways and 18-wheelers, the old-timers still pass on the lore of hobo culture and the secret slang and symbols to new waves of wandering millennial kids who have adopted their own rootless existence in a time of renewed economic crisis and loss of hope. The town provides space for a hobo jungle, where tarps are laid down and tents and lean-tos rise to accommodate the arriving crowds. On Saturday morning, there is a parade down Main Street, with the candidates running for Hobo King and Queen glad-handing the other convention participants in a last chance to campaign before the election in the town gazebo later that afternoon. Following the parade, the hobo's distinctive recipe for a catch-as-catch-can mulligan stew is served to hundreds of people in the city park. And when election time comes, each candidate offers a speech about his or her own life on the rails and the highways, and answers questions about hobo lore and landmarks. The winners are then chosen by the volume of crowd applause. Yes, the National Hobo Convention, like Mulligan's Stew, is a well-cooked mix of many emotions, moods, and eras, but it offers a dependable way to commemorate and acknowledge the significance of transience to America's changing society. For the last 85 years, since it began to take its identity as a hobo town seriously, Britt, Iowa is a place where the cultures of homelessness are themselves regarded as time-honored forms of being at home on the road.
The jails are made of tin. You can slip right out again as soon as they put you in. There ain't no short-handed shovels, no axes, saws, nor picks. Well, I'm bound to stay where you sleep all day, where they hung the jerk that invented work in the Big Rock Candy Mountain.
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Places of Legend, a podcast in which we explore historic sites where the forgotten and unexpected meeting of past and present offers a new kind of heritage experience. Our aim is to share our curiosity about out-of-the-way places and forgotten events. And we invite you to visit our website at placesoflegend.com, where you can find maps, photographs, and links to further information about the sites we explore. In our next episode, we'll travel to a farm site in rural northern Indiana, where one of America's most notorious and grisly serial murders took place in 1908. The tale of the killings on the Gunness Farm is a detective story with many clues and few definitive answers. It challenges many of our deepest preconceptions about the capacity of men and of women to commit horrific crimes. Who were the immigrant men who eagerly answered personal ads in foreign language newspapers, only to meet a grim fate instead of a happily married life? We'll unravel a story of deceptive appearances, the loneliness of newcomers in early 20th century America, and the shadows that restless spirits still cast on the residents of a small Midwestern farming community. Until then, thanks for listening, and we look forward to joining you in discovering more places of legend, available on iTunes, Google Play Music, Stitcher, and on our website at placesoflegend.com.